stop till our people are free. We ain't gonna stop till our people are free. And right now, across the country, I know that I could hear my people rising up singing this. Defund the police, give that money to community, to black people free. We are rising up in unity. Thank you for having me here, and I hope that people keep singing in these streets, because that's what all of our people out there doing. Love and respect to all our people rising up. Thank you for having me today.
Luaya, thank you so much for being with us. A member of the Peace Poets and member of Witness Against Torture, he protested alongside Martin Gugino for over a decade. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
This is KBOO Portland. We are creeping up on the 8 o'clock hour, at which time we will have the Wednesday Talk Radio program with your host, Paul Rowland, and Jackie Keeler. So keep it locked right here on KBOO Portland, your community radio.
And good morning, everybody. This is Paul Rowland. I'm your regular weekly host here on Wednesday Talk Radio. And hopefully we'll have my co-host Jacqueline Keeler up in just a second. Always like starting out our show with Buffy St. Marie. That was from her Medicine Songs, You Got to Run, Spirit of the Wind. This is our chance. And so Jacqueline Keeler is a Yankton Dakota and Navajo author and activist here in the Portland area. And she now has a Pollen Nation magazine on an associated podcast. And she's been talking a lot in the last few weeks, not only about the coronavirus epidemic, but about the Fed uprising, which originated in Minneapolis. Minneapolis is has possibly the largest and most cohesive urban Native community in the country, and had a major role in indigenous resurgence in the second half of the 20th century, including the founding of the American Indian Movement in 1968-69, specifically as a response to police brutality, which, as we see, has continued unabated. And Minneapolis continues to be a thriving center of Native American culture, politics, and entrepreneurial activity. And as I said, Jacqueline has been covering the Native community in the midst of the current upheavals for some time. I think she's done 3 podcasts. Are you with us, Jacqueline?
Yes, I am.
Good morning to you. How are you?
Good. I'm doing good.
So, as I mentioned, you've been talking about maybe just start out. Well, first of all, I may forget all about this. Did you hear that they pulled down a statue of Columbus in Richmond yesterday?
Yes, I did. That is just amazing. I thought that was fantastic. I heard that it was a coalition of folks who did that, so that was really great.
Yeah, and they specifically referred to, you know, the abuse of indigenous people at the hands of police in solid, you know, in combination with, obviously, or I don't even know how to say these things. You should talk about it yourself, but you've covered the issue of police abuse of Native people along with all the other subjects you're tackling. And obviously, as I said in the introduction, the rise of American Indian movement in Minneapolis was part of that. But talk about it sounds like just a fascinating a community there and culture in Minneapolis that's been formed over, you know, since the founding of the city. I know you were there in I believe, several years ago and got a tour of the Native community.
Yeah, yes, I did. I was there in 2014, actually, for the protest against the Washington, D.C. NFL team. There was this massive protest in 2014. There was a game between them and the Vikings. And so I think there was a protest of over 5,000 people. And I got there the day before, and I was invited, actually, by the American Indian Movement leaders to have a tour of a private tour. I got it myself with Clyde Bellacourt, the founder of the American Indian Movement, who is Ojibwe and was raised in the Twin Cities area. And they wanted to show me what AIM had done, what was still standing. And it was pretty amazing. He took me to each sort of organization and each, you know, sort of community endeavor. And first he took me to the legal aid center they have there. And it was actually the first organization, nonprofit organization that AIM started. And it is basically provides legal aid to everyone in the community, not just Native people. And so I got to tour the offices and speak to the executive director and the staff and hear about what they're doing to help underrepresented people in the Twin Cities area receive legal assistance. And I understand that Keith Ellison, the present Attorney General of Minnesota and former congressman, he used to be the executive director before and still had a good relationship with the Native community. And so he's very familiar. He's worked with in a Native organization. And then also they took me to Franklin Avenue there in that area is where the Native community started. And of course AIM started in 1968, 52 years ago, doing patrols, AIM patrols. And so because the community, the Native American community, was being assaulted by the police, and so they formed to protect the American Indian community from police violence. And then now I got to interview I think on June 1st, the AIM leaders there now. Clyde, of course, is not well. He has been fighting cancer, and so he has. So 2 other folks have stepped up to lead the AIM organization there in Minneapolis. And one was Frank Perro, who was with me that day and assisted in showing me these places. And he was there with the original founding of AIM. He told me, I did ask him in the interview, I asked him, you know, they've actually brought back the AIM patrols for during the protests because they have to protect, they have housing there. They have one of the only tribal housing in an urban area. And so they, and I got to visit that with Clyde Bellacourt. It's actually, it's sort of it's mixed income housing. So they have housing that's, you know, apartment buildings, and then they were building houses for middle class Native people to kind of improve the, you know, the social cohesion. And so I got to tour some of those homes and the community, and but they were protecting that community because it was right near the protests. And in fact, I interviewed the week before, the one Native organization there, Migazi Communications, actually, which is a radio station, and I interviewed the one of the radio hosts, and she they had the had burned. I mean, if you look at the pictures online, it's an 80% loss. It's a shell of a building. They need to raise $2 million to replace it, but they were able to rescue the audio tapes, the reel-to-reel tapes of over 40 years of interviews of Native elders, including my own relative, Vine DeLoria Jr. So that was one good thing about it, but they lost a lot. And so
the fire actually came from an adjoining building. Actually, yes. There was, at least according to one of the interviews you had, I guess that was Melissa Olson that you were talking to, right?
Yeah.
That she was saying that they're actually, people hadn't attacked that building. Anyway, we'll get into that. There's a very, you know, complicated interrelationship. Basically, the African American community and the Native community kind of live side by side and intermingle and collaborate. And there's just a strong connections between those communities. But I guess when you have a situation like that that's just so totally out of control, things happen. Bad things and lots of good things, as we see. But anyway, I just wanted to make clear if anybody had the idea that someone actually attacked that building, that wasn't the case.
No, the building is located across from the precinct 3, where the protests were, of course, where the police were. So that's why it was sort of in the line of the fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's actually a photograph on our program page at kboo.fm of, I'm not sure if it might even be Vernon Bellecourt. It's anyway a man standing next to a sign about the Little Earth community.
Yeah,
I guess
that's Clyde Bellecourt.
Yeah, okay. So people can go to another reason to go to our program page, and in addition to, if you want to listen to the show, if you didn't catch the whole thing, or you want to listen to it again, you can always go there, just like all our other programs. So yeah, you got a real glimpse at that, a firsthand glimpse of that community. So you, it must have been, you must have had a lot of emotions watching that as everything played out in that the community got to know briefly.
Yeah, it's interesting because so we had done a show actually on and then the other AIM leader we interviewed was actually a woman, Lisa Bellinger, and so she's helping to organize the AIM patrols, and we were able to catch them, interview them while they were available. Then they had to go off and do another patrol, and the two communities have worked together for decades, and really, you know, of course, there would be no American Indian movement, no Red Power movement without the Black Civil Rights movement. That was the inspiration for all of these movements, and provided the leadership and the foresight to challenge a lot of these things. And on Mother's Day, we are, so with Pollination Podcasts, we are doing, they're called, the title of them we've been using is Indigenous-Centered Conversations Around Coronavirus. And we got the idea to do the podcast in March. And because everyone was home and we were looking at all these issues and quite a lot of data coming out of particularly Northern Italy with the spread of the virus, and looking at, you know, this, getting stay-at-home orders and wondering what that's going to be like for our relatives on the reservation. And so we just decided to start doing these podcasts as a way of coming together and addressing issues that aren't addressed in the media, the mainstream white media. And so so we've been doing 3 podcasts a week, and so it's been over 30 podcasts since late March. And we have so many topics to go over. It's just so much, and we've had so many amazing guests. And for Mother's Day, we actually invited Yazi the chef. He's a Navajo chef, and he's been here in Portland before and cooked, a dinner, and he uses native food. He and the sous chef, who is Sean Sherman, they both are two native chefs based there in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And Rashawn Sherman is Dakota, and Brian Yazi the chef, is Navajo. But Brian has been working with the Gatherings Cafe staff, and the Gatherings Cafe is a cafe located inside the Minneapolis Indian Center. And of course, they have had to shut down because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And what they decided to do was they decided to use the kitchen there to make meals for the elders in the community. So they are making meals and delivering them every day to elders in the Twin Cities, Native elders. And so they so we interviewed them. We got to interview the whole staff. It was really amazing. And talked a bit about what they're doing. But with the protests, they had to shelter in place. And then the community came out and had to board up the Indian Center to protect it as well. So all of these institutions that the Minneapolis-St. Paul community has built over the last 50 years were all in that very neighborhood where the protests were going on.
Mm-hmm. And the AIM patrols, I guess, there's a whole story about how they got initially authorization from the authorities to be on the streets during the curfew, and then I guess the second night it got revoked, and there was a lot of confusion. I guess there's just a lot of chaos and confusion generally.
Yeah, I would say so. It's been pretty. They were a bit surprised by that, but they have been able to continue their patrols, I think it's been helpful to protect the community, but they are of course sympathetic and also protesting as well against the murder of George Floyd, so it's been interesting.
Because the lot of people in the Native community were out there from the very beginning in support of George Floyd and against the police violence.
Yeah, exactly, and it's something that they, of course, know very well because they've had to live with it for a long time. When I was talking to Frank Perro and I was asking him, have things changed in 52 years if you still have to have an AIM patrol, right? And he just told me, he said, back in the late 60s, and he was part of the original AIM patrols, he said, the police would take us out to the river and beat us up. Right, and if we were lucky, they would take us to jail so we could get medical care. And he says now they're shooting us, and certainly the Minneapolis St. Paul community has had shooting incidents of Native folks. Melissa Olson mentioned that Reyes, he's a Native man there who was shot a few years back. And her brothers were raised with him, and so shot and killed by the police, it's an issue that the community is still dealing with, are these sorts of deaths, of course, when Native men are shot, it doesn't really make the national news at all. So.
Yeah, that's a story. One of the many. Stories of sort of the disappearance or non-existence of indigenous people in the United States. So I just wanted, before we go on, that's just such a tragedy a sister radio station burned down, and they were broadcasting. Do you know much about their history and where and who they served and where they broadcasted to?
Yeah, they are based there in the Native community. They are, you can look at their website online, Miigazi Communications.org,
And it's MIGIZI.
Yeah. And yeah, they work. They have migizi.org. And if you go to their website, migizi.org, you'll see a page that says support our rebuilding and donate. And you can donate there to help them rebuild their so they've been, you know, they work particularly with Native youth. They have a lot of youth programs, and they have been there for many, they were founded in 1977. Mm-hmm. And their goal actually has been countering the misrepresentations and inaccuracies about Native people in the media. And so it was, so actually it kind of started in 1975 with American Indian journalists and university students discussing it, and then creating the actual, Migizi is Ojibwe for bald eagle.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it comes from. So,
and of course, there's a whole history of Native run stations, mostly on reservations, but that's a case, and there's probably others in actually a city. And I guess it's no accident that it was in Minneapolis, which, as I mentioned, is such a hub of indigenous presence and a strong community there.
Yeah, and this is where, you know, the American Indian movement started, was in Minneapolis, St. Paul. That's the home of the American Indian movement that spread across the United States and provided a really sort of, frontline response to a different sort of response than we'd seen in the past. You had individual tribes sort of fighting back against racism, like, say, the Lumbee tribe in the Carolinas, you know, taking on the Ku Klux Klan directly, and stuff. But and of course the fish wars that happened here, you know, the fish ins that happened here in the Pacific Northwest.
Starting in the 50s, which probably a lot of people either don't know or forgotten.
Yeah. So, sort of point of view, and actually Clyde Bellacourt, whose photo is on the Wednesday talk radio page that I took when I was touring with him, the sites with him. Him and his brother are the co-founders. Clyde and Vernon Bellacourt are the co-founders of the American Indian Movement. And Clyde actually got the idea while he was in prison. He was being counseled and inspired by a counselor there, and he spoke to his brother, who was not in prison. Vernon was a successful businessman running a series of barbershops in Colorado, and he talked his brother into helping him start the American Indian Movement. And so they're Ojibwe, and so they began working on that. And the history of AIM is not complicated. There are lots of things that happen that I think you can look up the trial, the case, the murder trial for Anime Aquash, that sort of thing, to see that it's a very complicated history. There's some other issues related to it, I've written about that particular issue. You can see that on my blog, Kiosh Bayan Now. And where I wrote about Leonard Peltier, who of course was a member of AIM, and the accusations against him of helping to kidnap Anime Aquash. I titled it 40 Years of Waiting, and I wrote it on the 40th anniversary of Leonard Peltier being in prison. And I also interviewed Anime Aquash's daughter, Denise Maloney, as well. And that's the whole... So I went to that interview with a lot of complicated feelings and a complicated knowledge of the history. And my father actually helped start an AIM chapter in Cleveland, Ohio, as well. And my parents had reasons for, you know, separating themselves from AIM, things they had seen going on. For my mother, you know, being Navajo and being from a matrilineal society, the misogyny was something she couldn't abide. Do you know what I mean? Although there were a lot of ways in which AIM stood up for women. I mean, my dad's cousin, AIM was the only one that came to her help when she was raped in South Dakota in the 70s and stuff. So there's this mixed very mixed history, you know. And but the so I went and but spending that day being shown all of these different institutions really gave me, it really did make me realize to the extent to which I owe my own experience of being Native, being Indigenous, to the work that happened there in the Minneapolis, St. Paul, in the Indian community. And they pushed the boundaries of what we could do and how we could claim our identity. I think that, like, my dad's family, you know, they were progressive Indians in the 50s, and they were, you know, engaging in things like the National Congress of American Indians, and they'd been doing these sorts of national initiatives for decades, since the early teens. And but they were, it's a sort of very aggressive stance, this very, you know, willing to carry guns type of stance that you see with in the American Indian movement and with the Black Panthers. That really pushed the boundaries, I think, and it made it more acceptable for us to claim our identity, to be Indian, to be all these things, rather than having to moderate it to please white people. Do you know what I mean? To have to be Christian or have to be all the, or, you know, we were able to really claim it to a much greater extent, you know? And and I think that it made it, that changed, that utterly changed my own experience of being Native. I think as a young girl, I knew it. I saw, you know, going to, my parents were very involved with, you know, different Indian centers when we lived in Cleveland and Denver, and we go to the powwows in the urban. I'm a product of the urban Native experience. My parents met through the relocation program, which was a congressional program that was a component of the termination program in the 1950s and 60s and 70s to terminate tribes and then to relocate the population, particularly the young people, to urban centers in Cleveland and Minneapolis, St. Paul, and, you know, all of these places, LA, you know, Dallas. These were all relocation centers, and so that's why there was, you know, in Cleveland when my parents were there as college students, there were like 20,000 young Native people there, and they began organizing against things like Chief Wahoo and other issues. And the same thing, it was a much larger community in Minneapolis, St. Paul, because of course it's closer to a number of Native communities, you know, the Ojibwe and Dakota, Lakota, and the Ho-Chunk, and all these communities in neighboring states as well. And I really, you know, I went into that with mixed feelings, and I was, of course, I was glad that I, you know, I at the time I was working on the Not Your Mascot hashtag and with eradicating offensive Native masketry. And they had actually, the AIM leaders across the country had organized that meeting with me with Clyde to, as a sign of support of my work, you know. And I've been on their radio show. They have AIM has a Blogspot radio show and Blog Talk radio show. And they admit, you know, they don't agree with me on my reporting on Leonard Peltier, but they respect what I do. And so that's always been really, you know, it's a complicated relationship, but. I that day, I realized how much I owed that community at large.
Yeah, well, so. As a, I don't know if you could make a, what I was going to say earlier is, or ask earlier is, so do you think that the fact that there is such a, I guess, a, use a kind of a bland term, but infrastructure of institutions, of Native institutions, including a radio station, a community center, the youth center, a lot of businesses, the Little Earth housing community. Do you think that owes all or a significant debt to the fact that the American Indian Movement started there?
Yeah, I mean. You know, it was a combination of factors. I mean, I know that, you know, it's having that large of a community there, eventually, you know, organization is going to happen. And that happened in a number of urban Native communities from Cleveland to, you know, to the San Francisco Bay Area, to the Oakland Friendship House where you know they organize to basically take care of each other, and that really that organization movement began in the 1950s, particularly as Native families moved to these urban areas. They moved there not only for relocation, but actually during World War II to work and to work during at these factories during World War II, like in places like Oakland, and so Oakland
and Portland. I met a number of people of my generation or somewhat older whose parents came to Portland to work in the World War II factories.
Yeah. And so there was this. So this was a. So I can't. AIM played a role, of course, and but there were. I imagine there were other Native based leadership there as well in that community, because it was. Once you get a certain number of Native people together, they start working together. And this is really what I think it's sort of ironic, the level to which the this relocation program, which was a component of termination, right, that it actually led to the sort of greater collaboration between tribes in the same way that the boarding schools did. I mean, the boarding schools were, of course, this terrible instrument to remove us to extricate our culture from us by removing us from our families and our communities. But the one of the outcomes, of course, was intermarriage between the tribes. And so you have a lot of tribes that are very distant from each other by having relationships with each other through marriage. And I think my great uncle, you know, he married, he's raised in Standing Rock in the Yankton Sioux Reservations. You know, Lakota, Dakota guy, he married a Chickasaw woman, right, from Oklahoma, because he was at Haskell and he met her there. And that would not have happened otherwise. You know, those sorts of relationships that were built by these institutions meant to, and policies meant to destroy us, have actually created more unity, more accord amongst these different tribes across the United States. We have come together more. In a way that strips away the old intertribal sort of conflict that once was a part, which was you know part of our history before, and so it's still hard for some tribes, especially the ones that have been stuck on reservations together with enemy tribes. I'm in Oklahoma, and you know, I think the Mandan Hidatsa Rikara in North Dakota. You know, it's you know, not all those tribes and those names were friends at one time. You know, and so, but it's that relocation program did a lot to create Pan Indianism, as it's called, the creation of sort of even this powwow culture. Which is shared by tribes from across the country who are not Plains tribes. These are not their traditions, but it's a sort of pan-Indian way of relating to each other culturally. I know that Navajos are often, there's so many Navajos that they do tend to have a force on culture. And I know some Ojibwes were unhappy with how Navajos were kind of changing the jingle dress, which is actually a medicine ceremony that an Ojibwe woman developed through a dream, but you of course have so many Navajo women doing it, they start to change it and alter it, and Ojibwes don't like that, and so it's an interesting. So Minneapolis St. Paul, you know, was a meeting place for Indian people, and it wasn't the only one, but it did play this major role with
the. It was kind of at the center. It's almost at the heart of the North American continent in a way too.
Yeah, it is. I mean, of course, it's there on the Mississippi, you know, and I got to tour the mounds, too. I went there. I was a little afraid because, you know, in the Navajo way, you're not supposed to go near the dead. And a lot of these mounds were also grave sites. But I, as a Dakota person, this is part of my heritage, you know. This is Minnesota was the place from which the Dakota people were driven. And of course, you know, when people have been talking about the issue of police brutality, and particularly in a city like Minneapolis, which is generally regarded as very progressive, and in Northern, what they look to, and I had shared an essay written actually by an Asian American writer about how you have to start at the mass hanging of Dakota men, of 38 Dakota men in Mankato, Minnesota, after they had driven out, brutally driven out and starved out the Dakota people. And so it's and so many of these Dakota people are now in South Dakota, the reservations. And so every year they do a ride, and I've written about it a few times in Indian Country. They do the Dakota 38 plus two, because there were two more men who were also hanged, and it's the largest mass hanging in U.S. history. And the Dakota descendants from the reservations in South Dakota, they do a big ride, and they ride from South Dakota to Mankato in the middle of winter, because of course this happened, they were hung the day after Christmas, and of course Lincoln, this happened under Lincoln's administration, and actually happened shortly after he signed the Emancipation Proclamation, which was around the same time. And so it's
a very, very complicated history. Let me just, I just got to stop you there for a second. It's a lot to take in. We always get such a amazing, rich, historical view from you, Jackie, and we really appreciate that. I just want to let people know this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the regular weekly host, Paul Roland, and also on the other phone is Jacqueline Keeler, who's my second Wednesday co-host, and we're talking about the Minneapolis Native community in the midst of the uprising and many other things. And the number to call in is 503-231-8187. This is a call-in show. We've already gone through half of it, but we'll love to take your questions or comments. Let me just check in with Sonia and see if we have anybody already waiting.
No one has taken advantage of that phone line just as yet, folks, but that number is 503-231-8187 to the listeners who wish to join the conversation. You can give us a call, and we'll put you on the air.
Thank you so much. So let me just take up with that. I know there's a lot more you want to say, but it's interesting that on the Democracy Now! This morning, with the guest Khalil Gibran Muhammad, who's he's a professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and Juan Gonzalez asked him a question that I actually was talking to you about in our phone conversation yesterday before this show, which was, he mentioned that talking about basically the racist history of the police, and he mentioned the Dakota 38, who were hanged as criminals, not as enemy combatants, because as we know, there's a long history of active warfare during the whole colonial expansion of the first the British Empire and then the United States, which struck out on its own and continued the same process, or even more viciously, actually. But anyway, so he mentioned that, and he also mentioned the Texas Rangers, which I was talking to you about, as examples of a kind of a broader look at the racist history of the police, which people rightly focus on the origins, particularly in the southern states, in the slave patrols, basically tracking down and capturing or killing escaped slaves. But there's a deeper history, and he actually specifically said that, you know, the more expansion, the more the United States expanded, the more it needed to have the internal colonies secured through the so-called criminal justice system and the use of jails. I mean, people know about Alcatraz Island, which was again a prison for prisoners of war, but the jails became tools for the internal repression process, which was just a mirror of the imperial conquest. Anyway, I could go on with that, but what are your thoughts about that?
Oh yeah, I did review a lot of it until you sent me about the Texas Rangers, and that was horrific, because of course they were at the border there, and they were basically conducting genocidal raids, and I don't know if you can call it warfare, but it seemed more like gang activity, and even the early police forces in urban cities could be described as gangs, and And, you know, now we're looking at the police who are heavily weaponized, and there are now demands even in Congress to defund them, right? To take a look at, I mean, we've all gone through the process of being promised reforms, but it becomes very apparent that the issue is structural, that reforms are not, you know, changing, you know, the drapes or whatever is not going to change the problem, you know, where it won't stop Black men and women from being harassed and being publicly executed, for very minor things. I mean, I see here that George Floyd's brother is before Congress, and he just told them he didn't deserve to die over $20. Is that what a Black man's life is worth? You know, and
I just wanted to something that I meant to say about that I saw in a Facebook post. I mean, they don't even know. You know, if it actually was counterfeit, they don't actually know where it came from. It could have been passed to him. I mean, there's a lot of questions that if he hadn't been executed, that an investigation would have clarified.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's horrific. I mean, and to think that the first thing I thought was like, wait a minute, we just got ripped off by, you know, trillions of dollars by all of these, you know, Wall Street people, and they got bailed out, and here, you know, this guy is being basically publicly executed over $20. It is absolutely insane. I mean, it's obvious that this is a system built to really keep Black people and people of color, Indigenous people, under a microscope of terror. You know, we've seen, of course, on a lot of Black people coming forward with stories of being afraid that they may not come home each day alive, you know, because of the constant harassment and use of force. And I'm really, you know, of course, here in Portland, we have people, you know, several days of folks marching in the streets, and now we have the chief of police stepping down in favor of Black leadership. I know I heard calls for Mayor Wheeler to step down because, you know, it's too much to try to educate white men about this issue, that what we need is actual, you know, people of color who already understand the issue. And this comes back to, you know, what I often talk about is that, you know, it's these identities of white and everything, the identity of whiteness specifically is a house that was built and that these people live in, and that they have, it frames their understanding of the world, and they have, it's very difficult for them to really come to the realization that the house they live in is not the world. And so they can't see or understand what we see who live outside of that house, right? And it takes so much effort. It's just easier not to have to do that. It'd be easier just to get someone who already understands the situation and is empowered to do something about it. For Indian people, and I talking about Vine Deloria Jr., you know, I after Ferguson happened, I was on a writing retreat, and I reread the chapter in his book, Custer Died for Your Sins, which came out in 1968 or 69. And he had written that after being executive director of the National Congress of American Indians, which is based in Washington, D.C., and represents, hundreds of tribes. And he had been there in D.C. during the March on Washington. But the Indian leadership didn't want to participate in that stuff because they felt that their issue was not one of civil rights. Their issue was one of sovereignty, that they were fighting for sovereignty for their, and they didn't feel like, they weren't convinced that civil rights wins would actually carry the day. They felt that, they actually supported Black nationalism. Actually, they felt that that made more sense because it was based on sovereignty. They felt that white people would never give Black people equality, and that they would never allow them really into their community, and that Black people would continue to be preyed upon by white terrorism, and then only through having sovereignty could Black people secure their own safety and space to I think there's a quote in the book, like to know themselves, to have that safe space for, they were saying a couple generations, which is actually, despite all the terrible things about reservations, reservations can be that space for Native nations. I definitely feel like my grandparents, who were traditional Navajos, they had that safe space on our vast reservation, which is the size of Ireland. And they were able to live their lives quite happily as traditional Navajos who never learned English, and were dressed traditionally and worked. They had their own ranch and raised cattle and sheep and corn and all kinds of things, apricots and pear peaches and things. And so I sometimes wonder, when I read that, I was like, is it true? Because I realized, like at Ferguson, Missouri, that the white people were still, even though black people were in the majority in that community, they were still being terrorized by a white minority, and they were being jailed for minor things, having their credit ruined, losing their jobs because they had to constantly go to court at inconvenient times, just being criminalized, right? And it's just, and it just, had anything changed? And it's just,
and, well, that brings us to the present, and this is what, 6 years after what happened in Ferguson, and there's been many, many more since, minor uprisings. But one at my age anyway, one hesitates to get too optimistic about any uprising. I've missed the 60s, but I've seen a few since. But there is something about this that seems, I don't know if this truly is, this almost seems like a generational shift or uprising, sort of this under the surface of this society that seems to be, has kept on in the same so many ways. It seems like young people have, enough of them have sort of changed. I don't know. Again, I don't want to be too optimistic, but what do you feel about it? It seems like there's something different about what's happening now.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think that, we are, I think what's happening is has amazing potential to change things. It's sad that, what's been interesting about covering, doing this podcast during this really 100-year situation with this pandemic, is that we have been able to cover so many stories about how the Native community has been dealing with the pandemic, and then of course this happened, and it's even before that we felt that the pandemic was revealing all the sort of cracks in American society, the ways in which we are not one people, that are historically based. And these things have not gone away, whether you're talking about the mass hanging of Dakota men, the driving out of Minnesota. Minnesota likes to call itself Minnesota Nice, and yet on the books to this day, there is a bounty on the head of Dakota people who come back. I know that here in Oregon, they only recently got rid of those horrible laws that were in the Constitution, I think, in 2001, which criminalized black people from living here in Oregon,
mm-hmm.
And that was after repeated attempts to get rid of them. And it was a decision made basically time after time in the late 20th century for Oregonians to keep these racist, laws in the Constitution, right? And so these things are not a long time ago. These are now, and these structures that developed sort of haphazardly, I guess you could say, like the police, going from I think the earliest example is in the colony of Virginia, where these patrols were started to uphold the power of the elite planter class, right, to uphold their power structure over people they were victimizing, enslaving. These slavers, we should call these people slavers and not call the people they enslaved slaves. These are people being held captive, right? These are people who have been more than held captive. They're being forcibly, these are people stolen, from their lives, from their potential, for generations.
From their land.
Yeah, I mean, we've all seen the book Beloved. I mean, who wouldn't, you know, when I was pregnant myself with my daughter, I remember thinking, like, what would it be like for me if someone could take my child and enslave them, you know, and not just them, but my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren. And it's just, you know, that level of horror, right, of viciousness in a society, it's hard to comprehend. I mean, yes, Native societies, you know, took prisoners, but, you know, for the most part, in most of our societies, those people became part of our societies. They were adopted. They married. They took the, often they were taken to take the, replace a child who was lost, right? So they would actually become someone, they would take on that position in the society. They wouldn't be slaves. They wouldn't, if not their children and their grand, you know, not for hundreds of years. It's absolutely, that's an insane system of evil, you know. And we haven't come to terms with the fact that so many of our social structures that are part of the United States were part of this system, and even the system of the westward expansion, where you see, you know, Dakota territories being turned into states, whether you're talking about Minnesota, Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, you know, and then in Canada going into the provinces north of there, right? And so it's, you know, what does that process mean? And it's a very recent process. And for Minnesota, it meant the genocidal elimination of Dakota people from Minnesota, right? And it meant pushing them out. And so,
and then what,
you know,
what happens to the, you know, that creates creates intertribal conflicts further down the line.
It's getting it back to the police element. You know, I mean, like you mentioned, the Dakota 38 were hung, not as, because that was an uprising because the United States was violating its treaty with the Dakota people, right? And they weren't providing the provisions. They were being stolen by the Indian agent. Children were starving. And so the leaders were, you know, demanded that this be addressed. And then when allegedly the war got started because an Indian trader was like, well, or an Indian agent, an agent employed by the federal government, basically told the Dakota chief, said, well, you know, if they're hungry, if your children are hungry, let them eat grass, right? So that they killed him and stuffed his body with grass. And so it's, you know, this sort of violence to people of color is really part of the creation of these states. This is how states like Oregon and Minnesota were created. That's the political basis of them. And that's what we have to come to terms with, because the DNA of this country is based on exclusion, is based on racial exclusion. I mean, the Northwest territories, you know, that that original law of expansion passed, you know, in the 1780s by was all built on this sort of thing of when 5,000 voting men could enter the territory, then they could apply to be a territory, and then once it was like I can't remember, like 50,000, then they could apply to be a state, right? And of course, at that time, voting meant owning land, meant being white, right? So there's always this implication in the creation of states and territories from Indian land of white rule, of white supremacy, right? And so this is why these things are. And so I am hopeful. I think that there is we're seeing the political power, the flexing of political power of a new generation, which is very large. It's the largest generation since the boomer generation, and also but it's far more ethnically and racially mixed, so it's going to be creating a new America, a new vision. And I hope that I think there's that saying, we don't need allies, we need accomplices, right? I think Cleveland Ollie wrote a whole essay about that, and the Navajo anarchist, and it's you know, I hope that these folks can be accomplices with Indigenous people and Indigenous nations, recognizing our sovereignty. I think we're only made stronger that way as humans, I think, to make right this this wrong, and to both Indigenous people and to the descendants of people stolen from Africa, right, and forced to build. I mean, you know, what are Black lives worth? You know, I think that, you know, this is, you know, I mean, that it's just horrific, you know. And
let me just break in and see. I know I haven't checked in with Sonia in quite a while. Has anyone called in? Is anyone waiting?
We did have a call from Mike. Let's see if Mike is still with us. Are you still with us, Mike?
Good morning.
Go ahead. You're on.
Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I hate to interrupt this fantastic talk. I did some growing up in Minnesota, and it was this particularly brutal situation, kicking natives out of that area. Wow. But something that always has stuck with me, and I've passed this on with friends over the years, is there is some education in the schools about some wonderful traits and strengths of the different groups and different tribes. And it's great to see them all coming together. And I've been a part as much as I can. I wish I could do more, but it always struck me about the Ojibwe and Chippewa, and then the difference between the horse cultures that came up. Maybe you could talk about that. But anyway, I know time's running short. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, it's my family, my dad's family are in South Dakota, and are the Yanktons, the Hankdawan Dakota people, which we are one of the seven council fires of the Dakota Lakota Nation, what is often called, we signed treaties with the U.S. Under the name of the Great Sioux Nation. We were originally in southern Minnesota, and Pipestone Quarry there in Minnesota used to be part of our reservation until the 1920s. We fought to keep it, but they were determined to have it. And I did get to travel south from Minneapolis. I traveled from Minneapolis to the Yankton Sioux Reservation, and sort of tracing that route. And I traveled through Mankato, and I found around there, I stopped at a museum by the side of the road, and they had a map of all the Yankton villages that used to be around Mankato. I was surprised. I hadn't realized we live that far east. And it was interesting to look at the woodlands there, and it's so different than the prairie where we were moved to. I think the Yankton territory always went to the Missouri River, but it was interesting to see. And they had paintings, watercolors of Yankton women doing maple syrup, getting maple syrup from the trees. And that's not something that we do anymore. We don't remember any of that because we've been removed from that area for so long. And of course the Ojibwe are there as well. I don't really know a lot about them, actually, to tell the truth. I mean, they were our enemies. I know that a lot of Dakota people say that, you know, a lot of the land they occupy was fairly recent. They came with French guns. They were part French, from Quebec, from up north, and they came and they invaded our territory and took over a lot of those rice fields. And I have Ojibwe friends who tease me and go like, "Well, thank you for the rice." You know what I mean? So I don't really, I can't really speak to them culturally very much, but they are really a real presence, a real vital and vibrant presence of Indigenous community there still in Minnesota. They weren't driven out the way that Dakota people were. But there are Dakota reservations there as well. Of course, there's Shakopee with the casino there, who remain who are a great support, financial support to many other Dakota Lakota tribes in South Dakota and North Dakota. And it's a rich, complex tapestry, it's also very based in the and it's interesting to think of Dakota people being more of a Great Lakes people there. You see that more, that sort of basis of being on the Great Lakes. And then but of course in South Dakota and North Dakota, it's more the plains culture, which came with the horse And so there are all these stories that supposedly sort of traditional cultural stories that delineate when we made the choice from being a people who grew corn. You know, the Yankees were in the southeastern part of the, we were of the range of the Dakota people.
Jacqueline, I'm sorry. I'm gonna. This is gonna probably take another 5 minutes. So sorry. we only have 20 seconds left. So we're gonna have to leave it there.
But I definitely encourage you to check out Migazi and to support that radio station. And there are many other and podcasts at Pollination. You can check out our Facebook page. And if you like our Facebook page, Pollination Magazine, pollen as in corn pollen, and nation as in nation. Then you can you'll be alerted when we go live on Facebook.
Okay, thank you so much, Jacqueline Keeler. Once again, always enjoy talking to you and hearing what you got to say. Thank you so much. All right, bye. We're gonna go out with that. But you can see yourself a winner beyond the money and the greed.
Run! Run.